You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour, and we are here in our second week discussing Solari Gentil's The Mystery Writer, chapters 15 to 25 this week on the show, Herds. And Theodosia Benton, our protagonist in this here novel, has continued to get herself in trouble, except she's not really getting herself in trouble. It's just that everyone around her keeps dying.
Keep finding her in trouble, and she keeps needing to vacate the premises quickly, which is quite fun.
Yeah, the fans, the audience, the participants on The Shield, this shady website where these theories are getting thrown around online, they know what they know. Where they go one, they go all. And they all go to Gus Benton's house and stage a January 6th.
I was going to say, yeah. It's so funny. It's so strange the lead up to this scene, because the journalist, Mary, I want to say Calhoun. I know it's not Calhoun, but Mary Cowell, is it? Look, Mary shows up with her army of reporters and everybody's like, what do? Theo screwed up. We're in lockdown mode now. Gus needs to leave to go to work. So he makes a joke at the reporters and they shovel snow together. It's a very charming moment of Gus showing his charismatic side to the sort of public.
Oh yes.
And then just as Theo's thinking, wow, it really looks like Gus has got this handled, that's when the zombie hordes turn up and chuck a brick through a window.
Oh yeah.
And someone apparently tries to shoot her, which is wild. They shuttle her off, of course.
Yeah, we have to go hide from the zombie hordes, the risen dead, and we go to Cormac's house.
I need to confess that when I read this stretch of chapters and Max talking about his weird conservative gun-toting family with a fortress out in the woods, the Ponderosa, I thought, well, obviously that's where we have to go now, because that sounds like the safest place to Theo. Spoilers for the end of this stretch of chapters about where we're going next, but the first stop is Max's house, because Theo has to go have an awkward confrontation at Max's house with the rest of his family. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know a ton about what's going on here, but there's a bonanza of events. Theo's going down this rabbit hole here where she has had so many people perish in her immediate vicinity that she knows she didn't kill, unless we're going for an unreliable narrator thing, so she has to kind of start suspecting the people in her immediate periphery. And there's this constant like resistance from her to do that. And the really interesting hook that I actually really loved about this book is that as she's clearly starting to see the conspiracy lines in what's happening around her, the play to the audience that Solari makes is effectively, she's thinking, oh, conspiracy theorists, weird people, strange people. And you're like, oh, it's Max's family. Max's family did it. Max's family did it. And then at that second, Max's family shows up with a gun to the back of Theo's heads and like, what are you doing in my dang bedroom?
Because they're all weird in different ways, obviously. Like the two sons that aren't Max, I mean, Max got his own weirdness going on. He's like aversion to guns after being shot by his mother as a child.
Who then performed to the best of us?
First aid on him. Well, that's what's really fun about it, is that it's like, my mother accidentally shot me and she told me to lie to everybody about it. But also, she saved my life after shooting me. So she does care about him. She's just not very good at gun control.
And also this implication that if he hadn't been shot by his mother, he never would have found the help to escape their conspiracy web.
I like that the fact that Max's family is a bunch of whack jobs who believe in crazy stuff has turned Mac into a truth hunting man. I like that idea a lot. I just want to give full props to that concept.
Well, I mean, that's a thematic that goes through the novel, right? Where Gus couldn't get justice for his kid sister, so he became a lawyer. Theodosia couldn't be her own person, so she became a writer.
To write her own worlds, yeah.
Yeah.
She didn't want to live in the world that her grandfather had constructed for her, so she decided to create her own worlds that she could explore on her own authority. And yeah, I really do enjoy that thematic. I specifically enjoy the like detective origin story of like, I'm sick of being lied to all the time. Now I understand what a lie is and how to detect it. So I'm going to put that skill to use. I think that's really cool.
The thing I can't remember heard was when we covered Tara Moss's The Ghosts of Paris.
Oh my goodness, yes.
They had a word for what Billy Walker was in those novels because she couldn't legally be a private eye in Australia.
I couldn't tell you. I remember that there was a sniper chase scene through a crumbling tower, but I don't remember what she called herself.
The reason I bring it up is because one of the other things that's been going along is that, of course, everyone in the story, aside from Gus, has sort of struggled to accept that they are who they are, where Mac, you know, everyone's like, oh, so you're a private eye. And he's like, no, I'm not.
Interesting that you say that Gus, like, seems to have accepted who he is, because I feel like even if he doesn't say that he hasn't accepted it, but like his house is a mess and he's jumping from relationship to relationship. Like there are signs that even if he doesn't say to Theo, who is the point of view protagonist, and his sister, like, I haven't accepted who I am or what my lot is in life. Like, he's still doing all this stupid stuff that is symptomatic of that desire to, like, be something different or to resist the status quo, right?
I think one of the most interesting things about it, it's something that is prevalent through our sort of core cast, but doesn't extend as much to everyone else. Like, there is an implication that Zeke, Mac's older brother, became a doctor because he was inspired by his mother performing first aid on his younger brother after he was shot. But, like, he's the only character in the extended cast that I think really it applies to.
I suppose. I feel like Zeke being a doctor is also just to kind of set him up for future problems. But I do like that angle. I mean, This novel definitely is interested in the conversation around, like, control in terms of, like, Mac's family kind of giving structure to their family's lives so that even if we can see from the outside, you know, there's programming going on, there's problems with this family, it does give them something to do. And as with all good B-level horror movies, the fact that they're a bunch of right-wing nut jobs is going to come in handy at some point.
That aside, I think one of the other interesting things that we start to get into a bit more in this, and it's more in the subtext of the kind of opening internet things to each chapter, we have this sort of narrative on the shield where you see the kind of cognitive dissonance between, like, oh, well, the state and the authorities and all of these big corporations are all in on it, but the police, who have nothing to do with any of that, are all, like, they're with us.
It wouldn't be, why aren't the police doing anything? It'd be like, the police aren't doing anything. That means she's definitely the killer because they're protecting her, right? That would be kind of the through line there. And I feel like in trying to keep a more exciting tone, we are divorced a little bit from, you know, how would these people actually react? How many guns would they bring to shoot up
the
house or whatever?
That's, you know, exactly it, right? In that, coming back to that horror movie analogy you've made a couple of times, the conspiracy board sort of operates the same way, where the conspiracy board is there to, like, ramp up the excitement more than they are to actually ponder the consequences of that thinking.
Yeah. Well, the purpose of a lot of those organizations in horror movies is usually to act as a wrap-up mechanism, because there's really no larger spectacle than having a conspiracy theorist mercenary group go and blow up a factory full of white alien goop. For example, just to pull a random example out of thin air. Shout out to the stuff. Anyway,
I think the other thing that's particularly interesting about the, like, conspiracies that we have going on here that I think would have actually been kind of fun is that one of the tropes of, like, conspiratorial thinking in the real world is this idea that they keep predicting things that don't happen and then they invent an excuse for why it didn't happen, and then that kind of keeps going, and it is observably complete nonsense. And I think one of the things that would have been kind of fun in this book, which does happen, like, a little bit at the start when Primus is still writing, because he's clearly, like, an actual source in the story, but it would have actually been kind of fun to see some more examples of, like, this thing is about to happen, then the thing does happen and the conspiracy ramps up a bit.
I was going to say, there is one event that's predicted, and it seems to be the publication date of Theo's book, Unearthed, because I think it's Primus is talking about
That was what I was saying. It's like back when he was still writing, right?
Mm. Yeah, this is when the Unearthed novel is going to come out, and you should treasure it as the great prophecy or whatever it is that he says. And they say, yes, December 5th, I have read it in the tombstones, which is a really fun way, because you could say, like, you will find the answer in the tombstones, and there could be no answer there, but people will invent an answer. And that's kind of the fun part of those those conspiracies.
Yeah, I guess it will be interesting to see once this novel, I think, gets around to December 15th, seeing what the, like, tipping point we have there is.
What the payoff is. We'll have to see.
Anyhow, you're listening to Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour here on 2SER 107.3. We are discussing Solari Gentil's The Mystery Rider, chapters 15 to 25. We'll be back with more of that in just a second. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. Now, it is that time of year. It is that time of joy where we get to cover the novel of our review season supporting author, Solari Gentil, the purveyor of the Golden Dance Pants Award. It's an absolute thrill to welcome back our local legend, Solari, to the program as we discuss her third metafictional standalone, The Mystery Rider. Solari, welcome to Death of the Reader.
Thank you, guys. Always a pleasure to join Death of the Reader.
Now, I guess the thing that I wanted to get start with is that we're three metafictions deep now. Crossing the Lines explored the relationship between a writer and their characters. The Woman in the Library explored the relationship between a writer and their audience. And now The Mystery Writer explores the relationship between a writer and their agent. What crimes did Leith Henry commit to find herself portrayed through Veronica Cole?
Oh, actually, you know, I haven't thought of The Mystery Writer as the relationship between the writer and the agent, though actually you're right. That is actually partially what it is. I was actually looking at it in terms of the relationship between society and story and how society responds to something told to them in the form of a narrative, and how it's so much easier to hop on to a narrative and to adopt that and come to believe that and come to pursue that than it is just to, you know, accept facts. So that's basically what I was playing with. But you're absolutely right. It also is a discussion of the way agents and the publishing industry deals and relates to writers.
Now, one of the marks of a Solari Gentil novel is that the moments of safety that we see semi-frequently are only a portent of chaos. How do you feel this book speaks differently to your style compared with your previous metafictions?
In terms of the structure of this book in comparison to the previous metafictions, it's much more straight. So I know, you know, talking to agents and talking to film producers about the last two books, a lot of the problem is how do you make it into a movie, because it's not a straight narrative and you've got sort of things happening in different timelines, and it's probably easier to read than it is to depict in a film, but it is also a leap to read it that way. But this is a straight timeline. This is just a story told as it is. What makes it metafiction is the background discussion about the way story works.
I think one of the really interesting things is that, as you say, the story is a bit more straight. The metafiction is less intrinsically part of the world. And that also means that then the action kind of has to come from a particular place. The website that we have, The Shield, where these conspiracy theories are being posted, in some ways can't act or be as direct as perhaps Leo's letters were in The Woman in the Library, where even when we do have these scenes where people show up and it sounds like it's come from the online forum, we kind of don't know in the same way because of that indirectness. And I think that was a really interesting challenge for you to work with.
Exactly. So what I was working with there was a background of madness. So in The Woman in the Library, it's a very personal relationship between Hannah and Leo, and the suspicion and the trust, and then the suspicion and the breakdown of that relationship happens in a very private plane. But what we're talking about here is a conspiracy theory, which we've all become used to dismissing. We've all become used to laughing at.
I guess I'm curious. One of the kind of clear themes in this book is how characters are shaped by things that happen in their youth. Gus, Theo, and Mac, they all kind of adapt to use skills that they were discouraged from using as they've grown up. I really enjoy the way that Mac was part of a conspiracy theory family, and now he hunts conspiracies and secrets. And these characters have all kind of escaped the communes that they grew up in with their families. Do we ever really escape the impact of our families?
Oh, look, I think we try. He spends our lives trying to escape the impact. But I suppose in the same way, I think some of our strengths are created because through trying to escape the impact of our families. So certainly for Gus and Theo, their families were on the extreme left. They were, you know, Tasmanian ferals, they were hippies, they lived in communes. Mac's family was on the other side. They were extreme right, doomsday preppers. But there's a great deal of similarity between the two.
I guess the thing I'm interested in there is you say that we are sort of strengthened by challenging those burdens that our families put upon us. But you're also saying that the shield and the way we are communicated to in society creates this background of madness. Are those ideas that we could compare? Is society somehow strengthened by having to see through the lies that we are perhaps told?
Look, I think it definitely was. Once upon a time, that was a skill that we seem to have. The skill of trying to work out when we were being taken for a ride. And there does seem to be more of a willingness to believe or to jump on. I'm quite interested when I was actually going down the rabbit hole reading these conspiracy theories and also looking at doomsday preppers and so on. There's a part of it that's a bit hobbyish, that's not truly committed. So I'm not entirely sure that 100% of people who subscribe to a conspiracy theory or who doomsday prep actually believe that this is going to happen. It's almost just like a hobby. There's this wonderful or funny show that I used to watch on the streaming channel with my boys called Doomsday Preppers from the US, and they would have a look at these families of doomsday preppers as they were preparing for various types of doom. So some of them thought there was going to be an economic crisis. Other people thought there were solar flares. Other people were worried about immigrants. And they were all preparing for the apocalypse. I was actually quite entertained by the way people did this. And the kind of the joy that they got out of doomsday prepping, which was almost similar to camping. You know, this is something we do as a family. We prep together. The family that preps together stays together, that sort of thing. So I do wonder whether people are as earnest about the insanity as they are about the working with their family to, you know, build fortresses and hide food.
Since we're talking about adjacent media, I'm going to shout out a video by Zoe B, Why We Secretly Want the World to End, which I watched recently, and it's all about how doomsday prepping is, as you say, it's a hobby. It's not as destructive as we might assume it to be with all those guns and castles and wild dogs, apparently. But it's also a way of taking back control when you don't quite know what, like, you know there's a conspiracy or you think there's something wrong, but you don't quite know what it is. Picking something specific and working to combat that thing is a psychological, you know, means of taking back your agency.
And we saw it during COVID when everybody started hoarding food and buying toilet paper.
Yes.
So clearly there is some psychological element in it that makes us suddenly calm down if we have 3,000 rolls of toilet paper.
But then you try to return it when it turns out you don't need it, which is a whole other issue.
Exactly. Yeah. But so all of that was quite interesting because, you know, I was writing this book through COVID. So all of that was hitting at the same time. So I don't know that when I started writing The Mystery Writer, I intended for it to deal with as much as it did end up dealing with. It's just that the world turned on me and threw all this stuff at me while I was writing, and, you know, I can't help myself.
I suppose, Solari, it has, as always, been an absolute delight having you on Death of the Reader, and a huge pleasure to have another one of your books on our shelves. Thank you so much for chatting with us and for The Mystery Writer.
Oh, well, thank you, guys. It's always a pleasure.
You are listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here talking with Solari Gentil there about The Mystery Writer, her latest standalone metafiction. We'll be back to discuss more of that same book in just a second. It will not end.
The book will never end.
You're on 2SER 107.3. Stick around. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. We are here discussing Solari Gentil's latest novel, just out this March, The Mystery Writer.
Woo.
Very excited to have a new Solari book in our hands. I am in the hot seat solving this one, Herds, and it seems that the devil herself has walked across our pages in this stretch of chapters, Herds.
I'm pretty sure you stole that from me, but yeah, you're right. The most innocent character in the novel, Veronica Cole, has had a sit down with Theodosia Benton. And I don't know about you, but I was picturing her with like a forked tongue and yellow eyes and like devil horns behind her.
Oh yeah.
Because she commits the cardinal sin. I know we're going to get to your theory. This has nothing to do with any possible theories you may have, but the way that she talks and she says, "Yes, Theodosia," that's her voice. "Yes, Theodosia, you mustn't look any deeper into the secrets of this narrative. Leave it to the police. I'm sure they'll be fine." Like, it's like in both in journalism and in murder mystery books, if somebody's telling you don't look into the mystery of the murder mystery book, they're evil. It's bad. It's bad news or incompetent.
At the like, very best, they are morally reprehensible. At worst, they are the killer.
It's the cardinal sin of telling a detective not to detect. Like, what are you talking about, Veronica? Get out of here. Get out of this book. Anyway, yeah. We've only seen her a couple of times. Theo's only had two actual conversations, though we've seen her sort of in the background of some of the scenes. But every time she's on screen, she speaks in a way that feels very manipulative, but is also very direct about what she wants, which is for Theo to sign the damn contract, which she can only break out of via some sort of fiddle contest.
She wants her to sign the contract after saying, "Oh goodness, did Dan offer that? Well, that would be ridiculous. That'd be out of the question," making it seem like we're using actual sales tactics here.
Yeah, we are. We're using psychological foot in the door nonsense.
Solari very much feeling as though she's actually talking about the industry she's experienced here, where like they're trying to put pressure on you to sign.
I do enjoy that, even if it is very silly.
Oh yeah.
She's a very silly character.
One of the most interesting things about this stretch, and particularly trying to put a theory together for this stretch,
mm-hmm.
is that we seem to kind of be ticking suspects off at this point in like a bit of a rotating way, where, as I mentioned in the first part of the show today, we have this sequence where Theo's starting to think about conspiracies, think about the stuff that Dan was posting about online on these like message boards, the shield that we read at the start of each chapter, and going like, "Oh, goodness, it must be a crazy conspiracy thing," leading you, the audience, to maybe it's Max family, and then Max family show up, so it kind of can't be them. The person I'm going to have to throw under the bus today is going to either have to be Caleb or Gus, because they're the only like really main characters that are in the situation enough. And, you know, Caleb's kind of posed as that threat because of his initial appearances where he's like, "I'll make them understand when I'm in charge."
He's a loose cannon.
Yeah, they can't be compelling. And the interesting thing I think about this is that if you didn't spot Daedalus in his labyrinth, then it would be really difficult to actually make a theory at all in the first place because of how the rug is constantly being swept out from under you. Like, where we have ended this stretch of chapters, I think, is the only place so far in the novel that I think I could simultaneously suspect Caleb and Gus.
Even if I didn't pick up on the wordplay of Daedalus, which is very silly, I feel like it's definitely difficult to like pin it down on a single person because there are obviously suspicious people. But the general rule of murder mystery fiction is like, if somebody says, "I'm going to totally kill that person," and that person dies, it probably wasn't actually that person that killed them.
Well, exactly. Which is why my today theory has to be Gus, right?
Uh-oh.
Because he's the only person who's been like around and in control of the situation. We have that moment you mentioned earlier where he walks out in front of all the reporters and like manages to charm them so easily that they end up doing his chores for him while he gives an interview. The thing I'm going to go with today is that like he really is enough in control of what's going on. He's so successful. He's so young. He has the big money from his old family that kind of means he could pull strings in the background.
I mean, look, my obvious counterpoint to that is that he doesn't have the big money anymore.
But he could be lying.
It's true. He could be lying about losing all
the money. The only
source
we have for him not having the money is himself.
And the ramshackle house he lives in that just got like smashed in.
That's part of the cover story. Think about how often he isn't there in the story.
That's
like,
true.
We
He's
have
off
this
at
scene
work.
Where Mac,
who knows where he could
Mac,
be.
Mac comes to get this tennis racket and it's like years out of date because nobody's actually been living there until Theo shows up.
You know what? The thing is, he might say that he has hundreds of witnesses from that workplace that he goes to every day, but actually that's the most suspicious of all.
Now, here's the other thing I have to theorize, Herds, and the big question I have, not necessarily for you to answer because that would be outrageous given the format
of the
show.
No, you have to answer. What's the question you would like to ask yourself?
What happens next?
I don't know.
We've had so many entrapment opportunities for Daedalus to get this signature. It sounds like they wouldn't have any resistance whatsoever. It sounds like they have her framed for enough crimes to take her life and hide it away. So, like, why haven't they gotten her signature yet?
It's a great question.
What is going to be the situation? Like, is that what happens directly next? And then after that happens, what next? I'm still so confused.
It is a good question. I mean, I asked this last week. It was a bit of a cheat, but like, how do we even end this? How does this go? We've got three bodies now. We keep moving away from Mary. I feel so bad for her. But like, she is a real character, this novel. She is our third death. This journalist lady who's digging too deep.
She's also like the only person in the story that seems to actually be outside of the narrative.
Yeah.
Like, truly?
This is something I want to poke you on, because last week you said that they could kill Bert Winslow and Dan Murdoch, if that is their real names, because it may not be their real names. Do you think that Mary Cowell is also like part of this conspiracy and is not a real person?
No, I don't think she is at all. I think she is the one real person.
So how could they kill her and not Gus? How could they don't say it's because it was Gus, because we moved on from that shenanigan. Why could they kill her and not Gus? She's a way more public figure. She's a journalist.
Oh, sorry. Right. I know the answer to this question. This isn't even slightly hard.
Let's go.
It's because Gus, to the publisher's knowledge, doesn't know anything about Theo's manuscript and about the connections that they had. Whereas Mary was sort of catching on to Daedalus and the manuscript and the drafts.
Okay. So I guess, what is your reasoning again for the murder of Bert and Dan? Like, why were they killed? The how doesn't matter super a lot. They got stabbed and shot. That's fine. You reckon it was Daedalus? Probably not. You said it was probably not Veronica specifically who killed them.
It was probably Spider Boy.
But why were those two characters killed? Let's just lay that out crystal clear for me so I can grade you.
Because Dan was about to be found out and was revealing the conspiracy. I think that's what the opening prologue chapter is about, is he's realized that he's let loose too much. Mm-hmm. And so he's ready to die because he's kind of broken the agreement that they have. Bert, I think they found out he was a loophole in their system because he got that letter and probably also the manuscript that Dan said he was going to mail off to Daedalus, right? Oh no, he was mailing it off to a different publisher, wasn't he? He was trying to save Theo.
Which manuscript was Bert killed over?
Theo's, the copy of Theo's.
Theo's manuscript, I see. So that's what the letter is about, when Dan, like, he like writes a letter like, I'd like to return your trust in me. So he's sending Theo back her manuscript. Is that what's happening?
Oh no, it'd be his manuscript, wouldn't it? It'd be like the revealing thing. I think the only major question I really have is where to next, because it feels like we've been circling this drain pipe of where and why and how Theo actually gets roped into Daedalus. And I feel like we've crossed so many opportunities by now that I don't know what the last straw is.
All I want to say is we know Solari's modus operandi. We have to feel Theo to be in a place of safety, and then dot, dot, dot.
Next week on the show, Herds, we are reading to the end of this thrilling novel. I'm having a great time.
I'm glad you are. I'm enjoying picking your brain.
I just want to let you know, for all of my confusion, I am having a blast reading this book. It's very silly.
It's very silly. I'm really excited to be talking about it with you. I definitely enjoy these novels more when I have someone to discuss them with.
Yes.
What we're here for. What we're here for today.
Let's do it. Next week, more of The Mystery Writer all the way to the end on Death of the Reader. Your Murder Mystery World Tour on 2SER 107.3. Catch you then. We're out of here.
Yeah.